And thanks for tuning in. You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville. It's 9 o'clock on Friday, April 10th, and you're listening to special coverage on the coronavirus pandemic and the ways that it's really affecting us locally. I'm KP Whaley, the general manager here at Asheville FM, and I want to remind folks that this coverage is an extension of the AFM NewsHour, so views and opinions expressed do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM. For questions, feedback, story suggestions, and more, please email us at news@ashevillefm.org. And just a quick reminder to our listeners that our program schedule has changed a lot to allow for a majority of our DJs to produce their shows from home. We do still have some of the shows live from our studios here to keep you up to date on the latest news and information that's impacting our community, like this one. And as news media, Asheville FM is considered an essential service, and we intend to continue serving our community with news and information about what's happening, as well as music and other programming to help you get through this time of crisis. You can check out our new schedule to find your favorite show at ashevillefm.org. And today, this hour, we're going to be talking about how the crisis is affecting victims of domestic violence as more and more people are forced to stay home. Stress and anxiety levels go through the roof from everything from lost jobs to simply fear of this virus and what it might bring to a family. Those things kind of create a perfect storm for domestic violence victims. And I'm really pleased to welcome two guests working in this field in our community, April Burgess Johnson, Executive Director of HelpMate, and Jeff Sidoli, Executive Director of Mountain Child Advocacy Center. April Burgess Johnson has worked to end domestic violence for about 24 years. She currently serves as Executive Director at HelpMate in Buncombe County and is also serving her second term as Chair of the NC Domestic Violence Commission. April, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, KP. I really appreciate the chance to spread some awareness about how this virus is impacting families and victims right now.
Thank you. You bet. And Jeff Sidoli, he has an extensive history as well, working in the sexual abuse field for the past 26 years with victims of sexual abuse and those who sexually abused others. He holds a bachelor's degree in psychology from the University of Colorado and a master's degree in social work from UNC Chapel Hill. He also serves on several state and national boards that focus on sexual abuse assessment, intervention, and prevention, and serves as Executive Director of Mountain Child Advocacy Center. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
Again, thank you. And as April said, I appreciate you bringing this topic up for discussion.
Absolutely. So why don't we just go ahead and get started by having you sort of each explain the organizations that you represent and then briefly tell us how this pandemic, the situation, is affecting your normal operations. April, let's start with you.
Sure. Thank you, KP. So HelpMate is a 41-year-old nonprofit that has been in Buncombe County providing safety, shelter, and support for survivors of domestic violence. We do that in a number of ways. We have a variety of direct service programs for survivors who are in crisis or who are recovering from an abusive relationship that they've escaped. We have a 24-hour hotline, so any time of the day or night, any day of the year, survivors can call us and get immediate support and safety planning. We can help assess the level of danger that they may be facing in their relationships. We also offer counseling for folks who are recovering from the emotional trauma of having somebody who promised to love, protect, and cherish them instead choose to use violence to abuse, control, and manipulate them. We have case management services, which means that we help people address the practical impacts of violence, things like where am I going to get diapers for the baby? If I've left my home where the abuse was happening, where am I going to live next? And importantly, right now, how do I find employment to sustain myself and my children if I have any? The service we're probably most known for is that we offer an emergency shelter for survivors and their children who have to flee abusive relationships. and they can stay there and get safe haven and all of their basic needs met while they're trying to figure out what the next step is. We also offer a court advocacy program. And so if somebody is trying to take out a domestic violence protective order, which is a specialized type of restraining order for domestic violence victims, we can support them through that process, give them information about where to obtain various types of relief in the courthouse, and provide some emotional support as they go through that process. Similarly, if a victim is serving as a state's witness for a crime that was committed against them, then we support them through that process as well. We also try to work with our community and our systems partners like Jeff to make sure that there are structures in place that no matter where a victim first reaches out for help, whether it's their doctor's office or a law enforcement person or a child protective services worker, that they're getting clear and consistent messages about what help is available and how our community can rally to protect them. And then finally, but very importantly, we work with our community to both educate about services that are available to victims, like we're trying to do here today, but also to try to prevent violence from happening, to work with schools and faith groups and civic organizations and workplaces to teach the skills that people need to resolve conflicts without violence, to set and maintain healthy boundaries with one another, and know what a safe and respectful relationship looks like. So that's kind of the overview of HelpMate's services. I'll say that this is a particularly scary and challenging time for domestic violence survivors. Victims who were living in homes where there was abuse happening could generally rely on some periods of reprieve through the day while they or their abusive partner was at work or out in the community and not in that home where the tension and that powder keg of violence happens. But with the stay-at-home orders in place to protect the most of us from the danger of coronavirus, those same orders that protect the majority of the population, and which are very good things for our community to do, they produce a very volatile environment for domestic violence survivors, because they can't escape. And the increased tension and stress in that family really get taken out on that victim who is struggling to survive that situation. And I'm sure Jeff can speak a little bit more to this, but similarly, children who are in those homes where violence is happening and they're witnessing and sometimes experiencing that violence themselves, they don't have the escape of school right now. And so we have both a physical and a social danger to our children who are also trapped in these homes with abuse happening. HelpMate's seen a dramatic increase in requests for our services, especially with our shelter and our hotline services. Just the first 2 weeks of this pandemic during the stay-at-home orders, 55% more people call us on our hotline, and 225% more people are seeking emergency shelter from us. And so we really are working kind of double time to make sure that there are resources available to survivors. We are an essential emergency service like grocery store workers and law enforcement officers right now. And so when our community needs us, we rise to that challenge, and that's what we're trying to do right now.
Amazing. Thank you so much for that. Jeff, why don't you tell us a little bit about Mountain Child and what your new normal has become?
Yeah, sure. So we're, like April, we're a 501c nonprofit and work in the community with multiple agencies. And our primary focus is child abuse and neglect. And like April, we do a lot of prevention work and we kind of two-tier it. One is prevention work with parents and adults in the community on how to be aware and red flags and what to look for and how to prevent it, but also obviously working with kids on their level so they can seek out safety and make reports if they need to, or try to find a safe adult to help with their situation and oftentimes to normalize it. Some of these kids don't realize what's going on as abuse and neglect, but often we're trying to help them do that. So navigating that both through the schools and in the community in various settings. We also provide therapy services. We have about six evidence-based trauma therapies that we provide, not only to the kids and families, but to our caretakers as well, because often the child may be the identified trauma recipient, unfortunately. And then as we get them into treatment, we notice that mom or even dad have also experienced trauma that was untreated. So we have a couple of treatments that focus specifically just on adult-related trauma and for caretakers. And through that, we were able to reach both not only the child but the family to hit two generations at once. We have a family advocate that works with a lot of the agencies that April has mentioned. We coordinate our services with Our Voice and Pisgah and HelpMate, as well as the school, because most reports of abuse and neglect, the school is the primary reporter because that's where the kids are most of the day. And that lots of the reports come from there. So we're working pretty closely with the school system. Our advocate is also working with families, trying to connect them to services in the community, whether it's WIC or going down to HUD to fill out application or help with employment. We're trying to connect them to all those resources that they need in the community as well. The other piece that we do is we actually coordinate the community response to child abuse and neglect. So we do a couple things. The investigative piece, so for child sexual abuse and most physical abuse, kids come through us because we have specialized forensic interviewers that interview the children in at the Children's Missions Hospital. So it's a child-friendly, neutral environment where we do forensic interviews that are protocols that are set up, that are evidence-based, evidence-supported practices to try to elicit correct allegations. We're not trying to get the kid to say a certain thing. We just want to get the most accurate report that the child is saying, because in some situations, nothing has happened. And then we also have child medical exams. We have two pediatric child abuse specialists here in Asheville. There's 300 in the whole country, but we have two here in Asheville, so we're really lucky, and they're phenomenal. And so we also provide the medical evaluation of those children when there's abuse and neglect, and especially when it's physical abuse. It's often maybe bruising, but often broken bones or other medical-related issues that have to be diagnosed. And being in missions children, we have radiology, we have neurology, we have we have all those services that might be needed for medical. We also coordinate the team that reviews all these cases, so law enforcement, district attorney, Department of Health and Human Services, the medical, the mental health, the advocacy. And we staff these cases multiple times a month so to make sure that we're not missing anything with any families and that we're getting the response that needs to be. Because in child abuse, different than other types, when you look at domestic violence or sexual assault, is children often can't advocate for themselves, and they definitely can't vote, and they can't be that voice. So often, I mean, literally some of our kids cannot speak because most of child abuse is 6 years of age or younger. That's the majority of abuse victims. So they need that voice. They need those adults to step up and be their voice for them in the community. So under the current situations, much like what April has already said, that you're putting families, you're putting stress on top of stress. And we're neurologically wired for social connection. And this has really put everybody at a very big distance from each other and isolated these families. Kids are isolated from school. So all the protective factors, all the resiliency factors, not all, but a lot of the resiliency and protective factors that are out there, we're disconnecting families and children from right now. And so they're on their island trying to figure out how to do that and navigate their income and navigate getting enough food and making sure they have a place to live, literally. And so this is really kind of thrown a wrench into all that. And how do we connect with families? Because some families don't have wireless or Wi-Fi. They don't have a large data plan or even minutes on the phone. Or if they're in a domestic violence situation, the mom might not be able to use her phone because the abuser will find out they're called in about her child. And so we've really isolated these folks. Even in the school system, one of the biggest concerns is even with virtual schools, we're seeing in the county about 15 to 40% of kids are off the radar. They're not attending virtual school. There's been no contact with them. No one knows where they are. So that's the thing that keeps me up at night when I think about those thousands of kids that we don't even are way off the radar. We don't even know what's going on. And we may not know for months or years. Mm. So for us, we the first probably 3 or 4 weeks of this, we've seen a peak or a spike in reports. And we're about leveled out, but we've been pretty steady. We our forensic interviewer doesn't have any availability. All our slots are pretty much full or close to full. So we've seen pretty steady. And with things like the court system being closed down, you don't have the hammer anymore. You can't, you know, we really don't. We have legal processes, and law enforcement is doing a great job, but it slowed the whole system down. And so even from that perspective, trying to deal with these things through the court system, it's really kind of made the challenges to the system, as well as all the challenges that families are facing, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do want to talk more about that and find out what the situation is there. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to a new show about the coronavirus and its impacts on us locally. I'm KP Whaley, Asheville FM's general manager. And this hour, we're discussing today the impacts the stay-at-home order and the stress of this pandemic is affecting victims of domestic violence. My two guests are April Burgess-Jones, Executive Director of HelpMate, and Jeff Sidoli, Executive Director of Mountain Child Advocacy Center. I think I'm going to take a quick break here. Actually, I'm not. But I would like to know, Jeff, I'm not a psychologist, but I do understand that domestic violence and abusers are sort of rooted in power and control. So in a situation where it seems all of us have lost any control over what's happening to us daily, that must be such a trigger for an abuser. So can you help us understand what might be going on in the head of someone in that role?
Yeah, and I think you have to remember from an abuse, and that's part of my background as I worked with abusers for a long time, is while there's a lot of similarities, they are very different. You know, they're a heterogeneous group, meaning that they definitely have similar ingredients, but how it all folds together is still somewhat different. So each family situation has subtle differences too. But for them, yes, there's definitely issues of power and control, but there's other baggage that abusers bring into those roles. And yet, you know, you have, especially now, well, not especially now, but in those situations, you have substance abuse is another issue. You have mental illness. You have any untreated or unrelated traumas. So you have to think about it like it's, you know, like a tornado or a hurricane. There's all these ingredients. Separately, they may not be that bad, but when they all come together, they create the perfect storm. So for this situation, that intensifies it because you put them in a petri dish, and now you've really restricted. So if, you know, he can't get to his person that provides him his marijuana to smoke, what's he doing? And so, or he, you know, we've actually seen a huge uptake in pornography use over this time, as you can imagine, because, you know, most of what we have access to is TV and the internet. So, you know, it's brewing and it's under pressure, and you can't get away from it because you're literally restricted from getting away from it.
Yeah. And April, you have any insight on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the end, batterers abuse for a variety of reasons, but a thing that is sort of cross-cutting is that they can and they get away with it. Mm. And right now that access is high and those consequences are harder to come by because our community has other things that they're focusing on. And when we think about really what makes an abuser, what creates an abuser, we see typically a prior history of abuse in their own life. You know, there's that old adage that hurt people hurt people. Mm. So we see folks that have experienced or witnessed abuse as a child are much more likely to grow up and experience abuse as an adult, either as a victim or as an offender. We know that when you specifically look at young boys, that a boy who witnesses violence in their home is four times more likely to perpetrate violence as an adult. And if that violence resulted in either the hospitalization or the incarceration of one of their parents, then that boy is 100 times more likely to perpetrate violence as an adult. And so what that says to me is that we really can't give up on our sons, that we have a lot of work to do in our community to make sure that if children are learning these unhealthy patterns by witnessing one parent perpetrate abuse against the other, that part of what we can do to create a safer and more just community is wrap support around that child. One of the most protective things for children is a connection with a stable, healthy adult outside the home. And that can be a soccer coach or their uncle or a next door neighbor, somebody that cares enough to take an interest in that child and do some modeling and also some direct teaching about what a healthy relationship is. And in that way, we all have a part in being able to reduce and then eliminate domestic violence impacting families and children in our community.
Mm-hmm. And what about the victims? I imagine these stay-at-home orders have some of them cut off from their lifelines that were available to them before, friends, family, support networks, even the helpmate phone number, as you said. Some folks might not be able to use the phone right now. So what, April, what's the experience like for victims right now?
Well, it's just as you described, KP. It's very isolated. You know, isolation is a tactic that batterers use under normal circumstances to try to deepen their control over the victim. And sometimes that's overt isolation and sometimes it's covert isolation. So that overt isolation is, you know, we live out in Barnesville at the end of a 2-mile long dirt road. We have one phone and one car. And when the batterer goes to work during the day, they take the phone and the car. And so if that victim really wants to reach out and get help, then they need to lace up their sneakers and walk 2 miles out. That's pretty overt, literal isolation. But there's also that more covert isolation, and it can look something like a batterer saying to a victim, you know your mama hates me. If you loved me half as much as you said you did, you wouldn't go listen to her talk about me the way she does. And that has a very similar effect in that it's kind of like water over the stone. It wears you down over time, and it makes a victim less likely to seek connection. And when they don't have the connection, it makes it much harder to seek help. And so now we have both that overt and covert isolation happening that's trapping victims in these abusive homes. And so HelpMate has done a tremendous amount of work to make sure that even during this crisis, that our services remain open and accessible to folks. When it's safe to do so, we're providing a lot of support virtually and over the phone for folks. We know that that's not safe for everybody, that not everybody can access a phone or can use that phone safely. When we do get somebody on the phone, one of the first things that we're doing with them is we're making a plan for what we're each going to say and do if that batterer comes in and witnesses that call happening. And so we put basically a phone safety plan in place pretty immediately so that we kind of cover our tracks and the victim has some language they can use to not tip off that batterer that they've been seeking help and possibly planning escape, because we know that that's the most dangerous time for a victim.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of other services, we also are still staffing the Family Justice Center, which is downtown at 35 Woodfin Street. And so for victims who may be able to use the excuse of running to the store or some other reason to get out of the house, then we're making sure that when they walk into the doors of the Family Justice Center that there's somebody there to greet them and help them with their situation. And Jeff mentioned earlier the court system. So most court is closed down, and that is having a difficult impact on domestic violence victims, especially folks who are in the middle of divorce or custody proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
But those emergency relief options, things like a domestic violence protective order, those things are moving forward. And so I want to be sure to encourage survivors to know that if they need help, there is help available in our community. And the most essential crisis services are all still here and available for them. And we know that there's a heightened need and a lot of stress in families right now. And so that's something that we really want to spread far and wide, is to make sure that survivors know that they can call us. And if you're the next door neighbor, the best friend, the cousin of somebody that you think is a domestic violence victim, and you're worried about them right now, that we encourage you to reach out to them, to let them know that you're there to be a safe support for them. And you might do something like initiate a call with Helpmate when you've got that victim on the phone, so that the number that's showing up on the phone is your number and not Helpmate's number.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're really being creative in our strategies to connect with survivors right now.
Yeah, that's amazing. Jeff, what about, again, the abuser? If when I was preparing for this, you know, I was thinking, oh, we have, you know, domestic violence abusers, we have people who are doing this already, but we've created this perfect storm, as I said earlier, to create abusers. I'm assuming that if somebody maybe was already a verbally abusive person, that this kind of situation could turn them to violence. Is that happening? And what kind of resources are available for folks who, you know, are now forced to spend 24/7 with their children, and they don't send them off to school. They don't get any relief right now. And stress levels build, and all of a sudden, you know, a parent might become violent because they don't know how to control themselves.
Right. Yeah. And I tend to be a research guy, and this is such a unique case. They're really, you know, when people are like, what can we look at? And, you know, really the things like Hurricane Sandy and the financial crisis of like 2008 are probably the closest and most relevant things, where people were either isolated in some way or under duress financially and resource-wise. We know during those times, yes, we saw this escalation in domestic violence and child abuse, because you're right, it's a pressure cooker where normally they might be able to manage it. And, you know, even with my own staff, I talk about this concept that right now, you know, we're about a month into it or so here in this state, and the novelty is beginning to wear off, and the attrition from that and the fatigue that's going to set in is, I think that's what gets me concerned. If we're really looking at going through May into June to really kind of ride this out, how are we going to, that pressure on someone who's already at risk or vulnerable to acting on these impulses? There are people who, I mean, we all have bad thoughts. And, you know, the difference is who acts on those. And the more time goes by, the people that may not have acted on this at other times are getting closer, and we're pushing them closer to acting on it. And that's not to say that they're victims of their victimization. I agree totally with what April was saying, is that what causes this is making the choice to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what causes rape is rape. And so, you know, it's not like anyone's made to do this, but the ingredients are there people may have not made that decision to go and victimize someone else. Now they're making that decision to do it because they don't have that support either. And again, if, you know, you have financial, you have food, you have all, and often, again, substance abuse is related to both these issues of domestic violence and child abuse. And right now, you know, they're even talking about, you know, whether they close the ABC stores. But definitely for drug use, it's really hard for these people to get a hold of those drugs. I mean, and they may be self-medicating through that. And access to health care for those folks who are taking legal prescription drugs, it's getting tough for them. So even though they're trying to manage their symptoms or their issues going on with them in a healthy way, they're being challenged to do that. So it's pushing everything toward the limit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, I think I will take a break now here. And if you're just joining me, you're listening to a new show on the coronavirus and its impacts on us locally. I'm KP Whaley, Asheville FM General Manager. And this hour, discussing the impacts that the stay-at-home orders and the stress of the pandemic is how that's affecting victims of domestic violence. My two guests are April Burgess Johnson, and she's the executive director of HelpMate, and Jeff Sidoli, executive director of Mountain Child Advocacy Center. I'll take a quick break here and remind you that you're listening to Asheville FM at WSFMLP 103.3 Asheville, where programming support is brought to you by West Village Market, located at 771 Haywood Road in the Blaisdell Building. West Village Market offers fresh and local organic produce as well as bulk and grocery items. They are available for delivery or curbside pickup by emailing the order westvillagemarket.com. And a quick station announcement. Coronavirus is a nationwide health concern. Here are some everyday actions to help prevent the spread. Stay at home and shelter in place. Maintain a distance of 6 feet from others if sheltering is not an option. And wash your hands frequently. Avoid touching your face. Avoid close contact with those who are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. And stay home if you are sick. Clean and disinfect regularly. You can get the latest information at cdc.gov/COVID-19 or the ncdhhs.gov for local information. We'll play a little music here, and then we're going to come back and we're going to start talking a little bit about the resources that are available, and as April mentioned, you know, what's open and still running during this time. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Hold your heart. Need a different kind of man, babe. One that can hold and grab your heart. You need a different kind of man. You need Napoleon Bonaparte. Well, when I'm dead, no more good times will I crave. When I'm dead, no more good times will I crave. You can stand and shout hero all over my lonesome grave. And we're back. I just want to, again, welcome my guests, April Burgess Johnson, executive director of HelpMate, and Jeff Sidoli, executive director of Mountain Child Advocacy Center. I'd like to shift the conversation now a little bit and talk about the resources that are available to victims. April, you mentioned that a lot of that essential service, emergency service, is still open and available for folks. And I know that you were helped in pushing forward changes just here in Buncombe County earlier this year regarding that domestic violence protective order. Can you tell us about that and what that process is like now?
Sure. So the process is much the same as what we were talking about earlier this year. So if a survivor of domestic violence needs to take out a domestic violence protective order, it's always at least a two-step process in that they go and they file for an emergency order, which some people call an ex parte. And so that ex parte order is in effect until the case is set for hearing. And so then they come back, and the offender also has the opportunity to come back and contest the order if they want to at that point. And then there's a hearing with the judge to decide whether the order is going to be into place for up to a year, with the acknowledgement that it's renewable after that first year. It used to be prior to January that survivors could come in and take out that protective order at two different times during the day, either in the morning or in the early afternoon, and judges would have hearings twice a day. In January of 19, that was changed to eliminate that afternoon filing period, which meant that survivors had to be at court very, very early to be able to access that protection. And that's hard for some survivors, especially people whose maybe abusers that don't work until later in the morning, so they can't escape early enough to get to the courthouse. People with disabilities who have just physical mobility challenges being able to get to the courthouse. People who are relying on public transportation, which takes a lot longer mm-hmm. to transport them downtown. Or survivors who have limited English proficiency and need interpreting services to be able to access supports through the court. And so it was it has been a difficult situation for survivors who are in one or more of those predicaments, because now what they need to do if they get there after that morning filing deadline is go over to the magistrate's office, get a temporary order that they have to come back and renew with the judge the next day, and they still have to get there that early the next day to be able to get that renewed by the judge. So after some discussion in our community, that time was pushed back by a few minutes. It gave a little bit more leeway, and it's now tied to when the judge takes the bench. But that's fairly unpredictable, and so our advice to survivors is to still try to get to court very early in the morning if a protective order is sought, so that they can be guaranteed the best likelihood to be heard that day. Right now, with the courts being partially closed because of coronavirus, we're seeing survivors come in and be able to get those orders, but often, not always, but often the hearings for the orders are extended. And so that temporary order is sometimes staying in place a bit longer. There was some guidance put out last week from Chief Justice Beasley that there might be some opportunity to look at some electronic filing or virtual hearings to be able to improve access for survivors, but also to just protect the health and well-being of court personnel, which is an important thing to do. And so we're really just sort of awaiting information back from the court system about how those changes may be implemented and how HelpMate can best support those processes, because we want to be sure that victims are protected both in the short and the long term, but we also want to make sure that the important people in the court system, that they stay healthy and well, because they're important people in our community for the long term health and safety of survivors. And so that's a delicate balance to strike for that system.
Mm-hmm. And I'm assuming, April, that you're talking to I can't imagine if I'm in that situation that I would know to just go to the courthouse in the morning. So I'm assuming through the HelpMate phone line, you're kind of explaining to them what their options are. Do you give physical assistance through that process as well?
What do you mean by physical
assistance? Meeting them at the courthouse, helping them through going through that.
Gotcha. Absolutely, we do. And with any of our services, if it's safe for you to do so, the very best way to have initial access to HelpMate's survivor services is to call our 24-hour hotline. And just for your listeners, I'll give that number.
Please, yes.
It's two. Pardon?
Yes, please do.
Oh, great. It's 254-0516. Again, that's 254-0516. And so when a survivor calls that hotline, we'll talk to them about what the different types of relief that are available are, both services through HelpMate and things that are available in the community, like a domestic violence protective order. And then we'll talk to them about when they decide what kind of services they want to try to access first, talk to them about how to best do that. And so when somebody does come in to the Buncombe County Courthouse looking for services for a domestic violence protective order, then HelpMate has staff that's there all the hours that court is open. And so we can do things like make sure that survivors have access to the correct paperwork that they need to file. Once that paperwork is completed, we can connect them with the clerk of courts, who will make sure that that gets logged into the court's system, and that they will schedule that FaceTime with a judge to have that emergency hearing. When victims are eligible for it, we can also provide a referral over to PSCA Legal Services, which is a tremendous resource mm-hmm. in our community. PSCA provides free legal services in a variety of areas, including representation for domestic violence victims, who are in the highest need categories who are seeking domestic violence protective orders. And we try to make that process as seamless as possible so somebody can call our hotline. We can meet them at the courthouse. We can help them navigate through talking to the correct court officials and understanding what that process looks like. And we can get them an application in for legal assistance. And then when that hearing is set, we can be there to be emotional support for them through that process. And sometimes people need to know, sometimes somebody just needs somebody to sit beside them, mm-hmm. a person to be kind of a calm in the storm, to give them tissues and water, to you know, help them find that place of inner strength and calm that is in there but is hard to find in our most stressed out moments. And sometimes what people need is information about who's in the courtroom. What is the job of the bailiff? What does the district attorney do? And how is that different from a defense attorney? And so while we're not dispensing legal advice, we're dispensing a lot of systems information that is just practical stuff that survivors need to know to feel safe and confident in accessing that system that's intimidating for some.
Yeah, yeah. And Jeff, we've been under a stay-at-home order for a couple of weeks now, but the schools were closed even a week or more ahead of that. And I'm glad you mentioned the partnerships with the Pisgah Legal, April, because in this good work that y'all are doing, there's many different other organizations that are also assisting and helping. And the schools are probably one of the first line of defense when it comes to child abuse. You've got teachers and school staff and even other students that might be able to help identify a possible mistreatment of a child. So how has that disruption affected children right now?
Yeah, you're right. Those resources, again, are big protective factors. And not only the school resources, but there's school resource officers. So you have law enforcement present at these schools, too. And now all that's been taken out. And, you know, teachers, and I've had conversations with multiple players at the school system, is that, you know, they're doing virtual schooling. And as they're doing virtual schooling, they're seeing what's going on in the home virtually now through Zoom and through other media devices. And so they're, you know, within a couple of weeks, we are having conversations of, I'm seeing and hearing things that are concerning me, but I don't know what to, you know, then how do I pay attention to that? What am I supposed to do with that information? And when am I supposed to say something? And again, those are the ones we know about. There's a good chunk of kids that we just, I mean, I can tell you one of my kids, she has 22 kids in her classroom, and they never have more than 13 or 14 shows for virtual classrooms. So that's almost half her classroom that are just, the teacher doesn't know what's going on with them. And so not having that disconnect for kids, right, it's hard. And it's hard for parents, too, because I can tell you as a father of a fifth grader, my math skills are being maxed out. I can only imagine the folks who don't have resources are under pressure. And you've got family members. In the stay-at-home order and the kids staying at school, that also eliminated about 20% of our health professionals because now they're at home. And I've talked with some of them, too, because they're telling me they're conflicted. They obviously want to be home with their kids, but their colleagues are on the front line of fighting this virus and doing something about it. And they're conflicted that their, you know, colleagues are there risking their lives and they want to be there, but they also want to be for their kids. So even folks with good jobs and resources are being stressed under these conditions. So it is really put a lot on, and kids are not going to call up and report abuse. I mean, that just doesn't happen.
Right.
Very, very, I can only think of a handful of cases in 30 years. But, right, so now it falls upon who becomes the eyes and ears and the voices for these kids. You've eliminated, as you said, the school is the first line of defense, and they are the number one reporter, and they're the number one of the system, adult system out there that notices and recognizes us as kids. And
yeah.
So that's pretty much, you're taking that out of the equation.
So rather grim question then, once you see these stay-at-home orders lifted, what are you both expecting you'll see then in terms of people seeking help? Because we've all been discussing the fact that, you know, folks might not be able to get to the phone, or we don't even know where these kids are. So what are you expecting, and what are you doing now to help prepare your organization for that extra work? Jeff, you want to start?
I'm sure, yeah. So there's kind of two different levels. Physical abuse and sexual abuse in kids and their disclosures come out a little bit differently. You know, physical abuse usually indicates there's some physical sign. We have bruising. We have broken bones. We have black eyes. So that tends to be reported fairly quickly, or it gets acknowledged. It could be seen. Sexual abuse is not something you can look at a kid and know they've been sexually abused. And we know the research definitely tells us on sexual abuse that those things get reported much later, if not years later, if not decades later. So we'll know fairly soon-ish about physical abuse when this gets lifted. The sexual abuse will stagger for years before we know the impact that this had on kids. So it's really difficult to tell. Some of the things we're trying to do, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of our families don't have access to, you know, Wi-Fi, or they have limited data or phone usage, or the abuser is controlling those things. We've applied for a couple emergency grants, and we've gotten a couple that we're able to get some prepaid phones that we can get to our family. We can drop off in their mailbox and they can have it, so that we can do more telehealth for our therapy, but also video conferencing with families to connect, to do even parenting classes, or just checking in with families and making sure they can reach out to us. We've put flyers in the kids' lunches that they pick up at school going home, so they have access to call us and talk to us. But those are a couple of things we're trying to do. And our anticipation is when this gets lifted, and I work closely with DSS, we're all kind of prepared for, we will probably see again, knowing what we know from somewhat previous incidents in Sandy and the financial crisis, that we'll see a significant uptake.
Mm-hmm. April?
Yeah, I mean, I think our world has never been through anything like this. And so I think that Jeff is right to try to extrapolate some from other types of disasters that we've experienced. This really is a new thing that we're figuring out a little bit as we go, both locally and really globally. And so to some extent, I think that we're speculating about what's going to happen next. We know that we're seeing a spike right now, and that the spike that we're seeing right now has a lot to do with survivors who need to escape the situations that they're in because they're just not livable. But I agree with Jeff that there are some types of violence, there are some parts of that experience that really take a while to germinate in a person. And so right now, while we're seeing a spike in hotline and shelter requests, I think that after this, the stay-at-home orders are lifted and the virus crisis has passed, that we're going to see a lot of folks dealing with the long-term emotional impacts of what it was like to be basically trapped in a situation that they could not escape with a batterer who was omnipresent all of the time. And so I think we're going to see an uptick, not just in services in general, but specifically in those therapeutic services.
Yeah. And we've just got a few minutes left. I want to ask one more question, and it's heavy on my heart too, because we're also all nonprofits, and we're not only suffering through this, you know, viral crisis and health crisis that we're all concerned about, but we're also like in an economic crisis as well. And so we are losing funders, we're losing sponsorship and support. And I'm wondering how your financial pictures look. Where's your funding coming from, and are you concerned at all about that? April?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking that question. The funding situation is volatile and unpredictable and scary. The financial forecast is kind of bleak. And so for our donors who maybe have investments that feel unpredictable right now, then charitable giving can really take a decline during a climate like this. And so donations really are essential. This is a time of heightened need in our community, and every little bit really helps. We're doing our best to be a good steward of those resources. We're grateful for the various public and private funding entities who are trying to step in the gap and fill some of those emergency needs. Specifically, we're working with Buncombe County right now to try to address the situation of survivors who are seeking emergency shelter. We know that that victims who are typically fleeing for shelter and trying to come to helpmate, if there's a situation where we're full, we can usually rely on other providers in the region. And so a survivor may be sheltered in another county and work with helpmate remotely until we're able to get them back to their home county, if that's what they desire to do. But all of those shelters are full or closed right now. And so it was really, really difficult to find shelter options for survivors. And so we've been doing some really innovative things, like trying to help people get to a safe family member that's out of town. We've paid for hotel shelter for several different survivors and have tried to scatter people out so that they can kind of blend into the crowd and hide. But right now we're working with Buncombe County to try to open in a secure and undisclosed location an auxiliary shelter that will provide some more temporary housing for survivors who really do need to flee. That's an important thing that we do for our community to really prevent loss of life from violence that becomes a side effect of the COVID-19 crisis. But it's also quite an expensive thing to do. And so when we look at the additional staffing and supplies and food and all of those things that need to go into a place above and beyond the cost of the lodging, then we're looking at, you know, $30,000 to $40,000 per month of additional expenses that that HelpMate didn't expect and didn't budget for because nobody saw this crisis coming.
Right.
And so it's a time when we really are grateful when our donor community can step up and help support some of that.
Yeah, just staying on budget is difficult enough right now. I know Asheville FM has a spring fund drive every year. We've made the very difficult decision to postpone that. And Jeff, I know you guys also had a very large fundraising event that has been moved back to September, I think. What's your financial outlook?
Yeah, well, first I'll say I have been, it's warmed my heart to see a lot of grantees and funders step up to do really impressive things, whether it's on the federal level, the state level, local, private, nonprofit, whatever it is, that we've had a lot of people really encouraging and try to be helpful. And I've really appreciated that foundation. At the same time, piggybacking on April, we're not concerned, but this is unprecedented. We're trying to figure out what does this mean? Because there's a short term, but there's a long term to this too. It's going to change a lot of the ways the world even practices and acts and how we go about things. So I'm trying to be mindful of not just what I'm doing currently, but what this means 6 months, 2 years down the road. And you're right, April is Child Abuse Prevention Month awareness. Mm-hmm. So it is 40% of my donations come in this month, and every single one of those events were canceled or postponed. And so budgetarily, you know, our budget ends in June. There's no way I will make up any of that between now and June. So, you know, I have a really great board, and we're going to put our heads together, and we'll be creative, and we'll figure a way to do it. We have great partners that we work with in the community. And again, a lot of people have stepped up, and we'll do it, because no matter what we're going through, it's not anything that what our clients are dealing with, and my staff feels the same way. Mm-hmm. So We find a way one way or another, and beg, steal, or borrow, we'll get it done.
Yeah. Well, as we wrap up, I want to give you both a little bit of time here, to a few minutes, to share any final thoughts you may have, maybe a glimmer of hope in what's happening now. Jeff, do you want to start?
Sure. Yeah. The first, obviously thing I want to say to the community is that we're open and we are available. We, we're running still busy, but we have capacity, and we're figuring ways to do things through, again, video or telephone, or we still are doing face-to-face because some of our services have to be that way, and we prefer them to be that way in a safe environment. We're luckily in a hospital, so everyone's screened coming in, so there's a little bit of a barrier to help with that. But that we whether it's a phone call, just to vent or talk about what's going on, or deal with a situation with your kid or with the school system under the current conditions, we're open for business. And if there's anything we can do to support the community, our information's out there. I don't know if you're going to provide that. I hope our website or our phone number, but there is a lot of people stepping up to the plate, and so I want people to feel encouraged. This is a difficult time, but we can still connect and still be there for each other emotionally and socially. This is a very vulnerable time, and the things that create the most vulnerability is unpredictability. So we need to get past that and go to those things that we know are sure and constant to help us get through that. And that's what we want to continue to do with the families and children of the community.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, and we'll share this audio after we're done and make sure that that both your organizations are represented. April, any final thoughts from you?
Yeah, I would echo what Jeff said. We're here. We're helping survivors. We're working with our community, and we're being creative. And I think that through this crisis, we have a lot to learn from survivors of domestic violence. People have an amazing capacity for hope and resilience in the face of incredible obstacles. And I've had the privilege of doing this work for a long time, and that means that I've gotten to see people who have gone through some incredibly challenging and destructive situations, who come out strong and healthy and whole. And so we know that survivors have the capacity to heal. We know that same capacity exists in our communities. And even though we're physically distancing right now, now is the time more than ever. This is kind of the opportunity of this generation for us to really pull together and create and invest in the kind of community that we want to build and to live in. Society is redefining itself right now, and we're the ones who get to guide that. And that's scary, but it's also a tremendous privilege to get to create the kind of world that we want to live in. And so we're going to be here. We're going to help survivors who need us. We're going to find donors to partner with to support our work. I just have a tremendous amount of hope because I've seen this community rally before. I know that we can do it, and we'll do it again.
An excellent point to end on. Thank you so much, April Burgess Johnson, Executive Director of HelpMate, and Jeff Sodoli, Executive Director of Mountain Child Advocacy Center. Again, I can't thank you both enough for joining me this hour.
Thank you.
And we'll end it there. We'll please stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming up next. Again, I want to thank my two guests, April Burgess Johnson, who's worked to end domestic violence for past 24 years. She currently is the executive director at HelpMate in Buncombe County, and is also serving her second term as chair of the NC Domestic Violence Commission. Jeff Sodoli, extensive history working in the sexual abuse field for the past 26 years. He holds a bachelor's degree in psychology from the University of Colorado, master's degree in social work from UNC Chapel Hill, and serves as the executive director of Mountain Child Advocacy Center, and I want to thank both of those guests. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! It's coming up in the next few minutes, and tune in again on Wednesday at 9 a.m., and we'll be talking more about how this pandemic is affecting us locally and regionally. I'm KP Whaley. Thanks for tuning in. Back here on the friendship train. Yeah.
Hi, this is Wiley Wiggins from Dazed and Confused. You are listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville.
Programming support is brought to you by Static Age Records. Open since 2004 and located at 110 North Lexington Avenue, Asheville. Static Age buys and sells vinyl records, hosts music, films, and performances, and serves beer, wine, and sake in their bar with art gallery space. Info at staticage.nc@gmail.com. nc@gmail.com.
From New York City, the epicenter of the pandemic, this is Democracy Now!
We have a freak show in Washington, a totally dysfunctional government, which is causing enormous problems. And it's not that nothing was known. A pandemic was anticipated all through Trump's term, even before. His reaction was to cut back preparation for it.
How did the United States, the richest country in the world, become the world's epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic? Today, we spend the hour with Noam Chomsky, the world-renowned political dissident, linguist, and author, discussing this unprecedented moment in history and its political implications. This, as Senator Bernie Sanders suspends his campaign for the presidency.
It's common to say now that the Sanders campaign failed. I think that's a mistake. I think it was an extraordinary success. Completely shifted the arena of debate and discussion, issues that were unthinkable a couple of years ago are now right in the middle of attention.
Noam Chomsky also describes